My name is Michael McCusker. There's a whole lot of birthdays that I could rant off coming up within the next couple of weeks, including my own. So I'll just simply say happy birthday to everybody born in August. And being as we are now in the, might be considered the second of a three-day heat wave that is predicted, which gives us a little bit of a touch of what most of the rest of the country has been going through all summer, and a little personal experience perhaps with global warming and make us think about it. I'd like to read something that I wrote, so therefore I have to give the disclaimer that this is my opinion and perhaps my opinion only in the entire cosmos and multiple universes and those clusters of new stars way the hell out on the rim that seem to be breeding like crazy. Summers of Love and War. This is the 45th anniversary of what used to be known as the Summer of Love, 1967. And I've read this piece in one form or another, once or twice, and a few more times on the air. And I start with a quote by Abbie Hoffman. "You cannot have change without the young. The young have the creativity. They have the energy. They have the impatience. You need the youth to descend." Summers of Love and War. All sorts of people in prime middle age are reminiscing about the summer of 1967, which they call the Summer of Love, a drug-induced hallucination in which several thousand, mostly, pampered middle and upper-class white flower children briefly abandoned social strictures and sang, danced, and fornicated like most of us imagine our wild and unfettered ancestors to have done in the primeval veldt before civilization and Christianity dampened our freewheeling pagan spirits. Mega, that legendary summer, 45 years ago, was San Francisco, Baghdad by the Bay, historic incubator and refuge for many radical and eccentric mythologies. For an ephemeral moment in a nation torn apart by an unpopular war and racial strife, a quicksilver of fun and peace rippled through the stoned young masses who had swarmed into the city from all over the country with heads swaddled in blossoms. A song that summer urged westward bound emigres, "If you go to San Francisco, wear a flower in your hair." An ad hoc socialist republic boomed and bust as rapidly as an old gold rush town. Everything seemed free for the asking. Food, lodging, medical care, sex and wine, even the psychedelic drugs that fueled the dreamlike vision of a world of harmony, peace and love. It all went badly, quickly, of course. Before the summer was over, evil spirits had merged with the blithe, frolicking throngs of nirvana seekers, stealing, assaulting, and raping, selling toxic drugs, and generally creating an infection of bad vibrations. The rhapsodies of nostalgia about that long ago and faraway summer seemed to ease over the ruthless struggles of that period. That same summer of 1967, American cities burned with racial hatred and insurrection, also despair. More than 200 other young Americans were dying in Vietnam every week, and God Buddha alone knows how many thousands of Vietnamese were killed between each Sunday and Saturday. The dream world itself soon darkened into nightmare. Two summers later, the counterculture that grew from the Summer of Love produced its most famous citizen, or you might say its most infamous citizen, Charles Manson. The 1960s were set apart from other decades. They are not so different in their intensity, like the World War II wars were far more intense, or because they were flamboyant and colorful, the jazz age of the 1920s had more splash, or for that matter, because they were fueled by division and insurrection, the 1770s and 1860s make better claims. The significance of the 1960s is the example provided by the nation's indulgence in its youth, or perhaps more aptly, with a single immensely large generation of young people who responded by paradoxically souring on the nation at a time of unparalleled prosperity. The 1960s were a tumultuous period. The civil rights movement of primarily Southern blacks gave rise to a white civil rights movement of primarily disaffected youth who protested an unpopular and ill-conceived war that forced young males to fight and possibly be crippled or die. For the most part, the children of the working classes went quietly into induction and the war, and most of the nearly 60,000 dead and several hundred thousand wounded came from their homes. Primary opposition to the Vietnam War came from the nation's middle-class youth. As usual, upper-class whites were protected and could avoid service in the war, although many went into service, typically as officers, or were engaged in anti-war protest. Rampant ideologies and social solutions were conceived and died in the turbulent years of that decade. Revolution was a serious and futile flirtation, a malevolent and adolescent reaction against a paternal system that refused reform or criticism. Young Americans turned to animistic socialism. A new left replaced the old left and developed a political philosophy that loosely resembled Gypsy Law. They thought they could bind state socialism and social control with a tribal sense of individual freedom. The police and military showed the young resistors to authority that social change takes hard work and great pain, which few were inclined to exert. Reality, which means that all dreams take time for fruition and are modified by reality, disillusioned the youth once more. The now generation found some other nows to be now about. A frustrated few tried to push against history, but were mostly killed or hunted into jail. Accidental explosion of homemade bombs literally wasted some of the best and brightest. If the 1967 Summer of Love and Flower Power was a Hans Christian Andersen fairy tale for the young baby boomers, 1968 was surely a tale by the Brothers Grimm. It was a torrid year of assassinations, vainglorious battles in the overseas war, and increasingly violent anti-war demonstrations, generally set off by police and National Guards, armed with clubs, guns, and gas. The presidential campaign failed to change anything. The new Republican administration that was elected despised the young protesters and attacked them more viciously than ever. 2 years later, culminating in the shooting deaths of four white students at Kent State in Ohio and at least two blacks, both women, at Jackson State University in Mississippi. The government also staged a number of show trials of anti-war activists in the late 1960s and early 1970s, but juries acquitted them all. In 1969, anti-war radicals responded to police murders of Black Panthers and arrests of activists by forming a violent vanguard that proclaimed the beginning of revolution, the Weathermen, later Weather People, whose rhetoric was always considerably more revolutionary than their acts, and whose homemade bombs blew up in their faces. But 1968 was also a year when an international youth movement might have linked, not since 1848 had Europe been so united behind barricades. France, West Germany, Czechoslovakia, the Prague Spring, and in Mexico at the 1968 Olympic Games, and Chicago, USA, on our side of the world. Revolutionary politics are saturated with hoped-for might-have-beens. No connection was made other than sympathetic, though often inflamed, oratory. In 1968, the war in Vietnam reached its most dramatic and painful peak, the winter Tet Offensive by North Vietnamese armies and Viet Cong guerrillas, which included the long and bloody siege at Khe Sanh, reminiscent of Dien Bien Phu 14 years earlier. 1968 was the moral low water mark of the war, the devastation of the ancient imperial city of Wei and the slaughter of civilians by American soldiers at My Lai. President Lyndon Johnson surrendered his presidency to the war in 1968, and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. sacrificed his life organizing poor blacks and whites against the economic system that impoverished them. Robert Kennedy, brother of the assassinated President John Kennedy, campaigned for the presidency on a promise to end the war and provide justice to the poor, and was murdered moments after victory in the California primary in June. In August 1968, a peak was also reached in the anti-war movement at the violent spectacle of the Democratic Party's National Convention in Chicago. The whole world was watching. Although culturists claim the 1960s got into swing around 1968, the theme of the decade was set at its start with the Black Civil Rights Movement. Not only did the violent and passionate search for racial justice inspire the later anti-war revolutionary New Left, earliest leaders of the movement were tempered by their own personal involvement in civil rights in the American South, registering blacks to vote, marching with blacks, and sharing the violent reaction. The other major influence was the Vietnam War, which provided the ignition point of youthful, mostly white rebellion and added hardened veterans of the war to the largely college-oriented movement opposing it. The veterans, like the civil rights activists, were experienced with violence and capably reacted to attacks by police and state militias attempting to quell the revolt against national policy. The veterans who crossed political lines to oppose the war that seasoned and repelled them became immersed in leftist ideology, although many did not approve of it. Yet the political right had failed them, had inducted them into an unholy war cloaked in righteous deceit, made them prisoners of conscience. Whereas the early New Left had been inspired by the civil rights movement and embraced liberation philosophies, the veterans came into the anti-war movement angry and embittered. Most of the veterans had a limited focus that ultimately was fatal to their campaign, far short of its goal to end the war. Similar to the majority of New Left organizations, Vietnam Veterans Against the War, VVAW, was at first stimulated by argument, but eventually debate and disagreement degenerated into quarreling animosities that broke the group apart. All that survived were two mutually hostile splinter groups that orbited a far and exotic fringe. The U.S. government's most powerful counterstroke was to virtually end the military draft, which almost immediately diffused the rebellion. Draft-age males, assured of avoiding combat service, lost interest in the immorality of the war and also stopped thinking and talking about ideas and issues that grew from the war. Only diehards and incurable idealists persisted against the new wave of apathy, driven by a hopeful or grim visions. The New Left dissipated into a pablum of New Age kitsch. There were always contradictions among the countercultures of the 1960s. Hip culture chasing a buck in contrast to politicized hippies who wanted to abolish wealth. Nirvana seeking acid heads versus hardcore speed freaks and junkies. But everybody was against and in fear of the cops. The flower power dream of transcending materialism with goodwill failed, but not before it seeded the environmental movement and made ideas about pacifism, justice, and equality respectable. The most far-reaching legacy of the inspired and self-indulgent 1960s is the women's movement. The lingering problem, however, is that the fun-seeking nation adopted the sex, drug, and party habits of the young boomers, but not the philosophies or politics. Young Ben Braddock, as portrayed by Dustin Hoffman in the film version The Graduate, written by Charles Webb, spoke for a disillusioned generation of baby boomers in early maturity when he said, "I don't know what I am, Dad, and I don't particularly care." Later, that spiritual emptiness would gorge on frenzied materialism, but for a short period, a large number of primarily affluent young Americans attempted to combat cultural nihilism with experiments toward a moral republic which was to be lightly governed for the benefit of all persons by intelligent goodwill. Some among the large restless tribe that worshipped the image of eternal youth never got much older, swept up in the war that everyone seemed powerless to stop. A few endured jail to avoid the war or sought exile in other countries. Others resisted the war and defiantly braved guns, clubs, and disabling chemicals of police and National Guardsmen, many of whom enlisted in state militias to avoid service in the war. The drugs that opened the minds of thousands of alienated children seared them to ash in subsequent years. Although the baby boom generation temporarily repudiated the corrupt leadership and incessant greed of the nation, rapidly germinating and degenerating, dizzily heady ideologies and social solutions, it grew increasingly fond of the riches it had previously loathed. Most softened their resistance to the 7-Eleven values of their culture as they grew older. Communal patterns and politics were abandoned. Business networking among the former rebels replaced communalism. The happily acquisitive, workaholic, well-dined yuppie metamorphosed from the angst-riven flower child hippie who thought universal love and open sex would make the world a better place. Yuppies contortedly justified their pursuit of wealth and status as fully compatible with their lingering sympathies for social justice. Now the baby boomers who made so much trouble to their families and their country while they were growing up are as old or older than their parents a generation ago. The war that traumatized their vulnerable youth is long over, although its residue continues to disturb amnesia. The psychopathic Cold War they grew up with ended abruptly with the collapse and disintegration of the Russian Communist Empire. The summer of love was the generation's iridescent mirage, the watershed of its vanished youth. They were born after World War II, and their memories don't include the daily sounds of bombers and bombs that tormented and killed children all over the world a few years earlier. Yet their continuing angst is a legacy of their parents' war. They were born under the sign of the mushroom cloud. More than their rebellion against prosperity and its flaccid corruption of spirit, their dread of nuclear holocaust defined their passionate protest against the Vietnam War. More than personal fears of young males that would be drafted into it. This first nuclear generation, also the first television generation, felt a shared stake in the future, and apart from hype and herd instinct, they tried to be kind to one another. They are so large a generation, they crash through history as irresistibly as fire, remaking everything they sweep past. They are so accustomed to the attention of society, particularly its merchants, they believe they are the force of history itself. And that's something I wrote. And it was called Summers of Love and War. And all this movement you're hearing is my having dropped things on the floor and trying to retrieve them. And I'd like to follow up with something of a similar and certainly empathetic sense. The Port Huron Statement at 50, and it's from the New York Times, Sunday, March 4th, by Sam Roberts, who is urban affairs correspondent for the Times. They are mostly in their 70s now, those chaotic college students who drafted the Port Huron Statement at a ramshackle AFL-CIO education retreat northeast of Detroit in 1962. Today, their agenda for a generation, and that's a quote, survives most famously as a punchline from the 1998 film The Big Lebowski, in which the stoner protagonist proclaims himself an author of the original Port Huron Statement, not the compromised second draft. Purists like Jeff the Dude Lebowski might dissent, but historian Michael Kazin, who once was from Portland, pronounced the final draft, quote, the most ambitious, the most specific, and the most eloquent manifesto in the history of the American left. The statement that eventually emerged from a five-day national convention of the Students for a Democratic Society held June 11th to 15th, 1962, contained 25,000 words. That was 7,000 more than the Communist Manifesto, which started a global revolution, and 24,300 more words than the Declaration of the Occupancy of the New York City passed last September by a General Assembly of the Occupy Wall Street movement, which in 3 weeks produced the magnitude of protests that would take SDS several years to galvanize. But by invoking the spirit of John Dewey, Albert Camus, C. Wright Mills, Michael Harrington, and Pope John XXIII, by at once championing and chiding organized labor as a victim of its own success, the SDS began as the student arm of the League for Industrial Democracy, by elevating the university to the apex of activism, and by validating liberalism and the two-party system, Tom Hayden and his colleagues forged a manifesto that still reverberates. While most people haven't read it, it's still extremely relevant for its guiding principles, said David Graeber, an anthropologist and anarchist who has been active in the Occupy movement. For a long time, I thought the Port Huron statement was a relic of a hopeful past, Mr. Hayden recalled. But frequently, students would read it and say how surprised they were at its sounding like the present. Mr. Hayden, who was steeled by a Catholic social conscience, was 22 when he began drafting the manifesto in March 1962 in his Manhattan apartment. He was a budding journalist from the University of Michigan whose job as the principal author of the collaborative manifesto was to synthesize an introvert angst that had been germinating in several nascent and largely unpopular political movements. Its guiding vision was codified by Arnold Kaufman, a philosophy professor at Michigan. He called it participatory democracy, and while SDS would fracture, his concept would, in ensuing decades, be codified in school decentralization, community planning boards, and Freedom of Information Acts. At academic conferences during this anniversary year, including one recently at the University of California, Santa Barbara, scholars and grizzled activists are revisiting the document. Its last sentence was an apocalyptic downer. Quote, if we appear to seek the unattainable, as it has been said, then let it be known that we do so to avoid the unimaginable. Unquote. Yet while American campuses were awakening from apathy, they were still several years away from radicalization. The mindset of the Port Huron drafters, in contrast to the members of the Occupy movement, was that the fundamental values espoused by their liberal elders remained valid, and that money had not yet corrupted the political system so completely that it was incapable of being reformed. That is why Mr. Hayden addressed the manifesto to the young left as much as to a new left. We would replace power rooted in possession, privilege, or circumstance by power and uniqueness rooted in love, reflectiveness, reason, and creativity, the statement said. Those sentiments were echoed in Occupy's founding principles, constituting ourselves as autonomous political beings engaged in nonviolent civil disobedience and building solidarity based on mutual respect, acceptance, and love. Sure, there were important things we missed, Mr. Hayden has recalled. The environmental crisis, but Rachel Carson's book hadn't come out. Feminism, but Betty Friedan's book wasn't out. The escalation of Vietnam, which none of us expected, though we opposed. The assassination of JFK and other killings to follow. The subsequent radicalization and polarization that characterized the late 60s through Watergate. But, he continued, the core of the Port Huron statement rings true, and the theme of participatory democracy is relevant today, from Cairo to Occupy Wall Street to Wisconsin to student-led democracy movements. James Miller, a professor of politics at the New School for Social Research and author of Democracy is in the Streets, from Port Huron to the Siege of Chicago, suggests that the very concept of consensus at all costs meant that moderates comprised and militants eventually predominated. I should say moderates compromised and militants eventually predominated. Professor Kazin, who teaches history at Georgetown and co-edits Dissent, recalled, too, that for the anti-war militants who flooded into SDS after 1965, participatory democracy seemed too hazy and abstract, both in meaning and application, to guide a revolution. In 1969, the Port Huron Statement was absent from an anthology, The New Left Reader. But a decade later, it was excerpted in Diane Ravitch's American Reader, Words That Moved a Nation. Sadly, she said recently, I find what is most dated is a sort of naive belief that human nature itself might be transformed through appeal to idealism, and that somehow our institutions will be malleable in the face of idealism mobilized. Paul Berman, who teaches journalism at New York University, said that the statement's appeal to young people was natural and that neither its tone nor its prescriptions could be blamed for the later atomization of SDS. Could Port Huron double as a manifesto for Occupy? This new generation, whether anarchist or simply disillusioned by stolen elections, is far more cynical about politicians and elections, Tom Hayden said. But Occupy has learned the lessons of SDS, says Todd Gitlin, a Columbia University professor and author of the forthcoming Occupy Nation. The primacy of nonviolence is a reaction to the 60s, Gitlin said, as if don't have hierarchical organizations and don't have visible leaders. Gitlin, who was president of SDS from 1963 to 64, said, for the SDS, the prime enemy was apathy. This movement recognizes you don't have to preach to people that they're alienated. In 1962, though, fewer people were alienated. They were still groggy from the conformist Eisenhower decade and dazzled by the Kennedy mystique, which may be why the Port Huron Statement began circumspectly. Quote, we are people of this generation, bred in at least modest comfort, housed now in universities, looking uncomfortably to the world we inherit, unquote. Callie Lazen was 20 in 1962. Today, he is the editor of Adbusters, whose Twitter tag, Occupy Wall Street, branded the movement last summer. He does not feel the Occupy movement needs to look to the Port Huron Statement for guidance. If you ask me what is the most powerful personal and collective feeling of people in the Occupy movement, it is a feeling of gloom and doom, that they're looking toward a black hole future, Mr. Lazen said. I'm not quite sure we need a manifesto to say that. And that was the Port Huron Statement at 50 by Sam Roberts, and it appeared in the New York Times Sunday, March 4th, 2012. And pardon me for knocking the microphone if you heard that thing. I'd like to read a couple of quotes from that period, like I.F. Stone from 1968. This idealistic youth is the same youth already serving in the Peace Corps abroad and the poverty program at home. They are the seed corn of a better future. They embody the strain of idealism which in every generation has written the best chapters in our American history. They are the spiritual heirs of the Jeffersonians and the abolitionists. And Julius Lester, 1968. The student radical is never heard talking about a rise in the price of milk, new taxes, real wages, or doctor bills. The student radical creates his own society in which money is not an overriding problem, and because it isn't, the student radical thinks revolution is all about love because he has time to think about love. Everybody else is talking about survival. And my friend Michael Marsh said in 1971, you are a bunch of incompetent dreamers. You promised a revolution, and where the hell is it? Because you're too lazy or incapable of being real revolutionaries, I am being forced to pay off my student loan. And Michael Marsh died 20 years later in May of 1991. So there you have three different views. And I myself was a member of Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And I went through Chicago, 68. The summer of love in 67, I was still getting out of Vietnam and the Marine Corps. And I might show up next Thursday. I will be another year older by then, if the sky doesn't fall, or I fall into the river, or a truck run me down, or one of those bloody drones that we are going to have running around in our skies doesn't come down and incinerate me. I will be 71 and doing my little bit for the pledge drive for KMUN, which starts tomorrow on KMUN, Astoria 91.9. And this is also KTCB, Tillamook 89.5.